Blog Talk Radio.
Effects. You found us again. It's great to have you. Thank you for all the support over the past couple of years. Oh my goodness, we're coming up to our fifth anniversary in December this year. That's much more success than I could have ever hoped for. And it's all due to the response of the audience, you. Of course, we're going to have more questions to put to you today, more information, sort of that education and information all at the same time. But it's fall around us. We're in the middle here in North America of Thanksgiving. Interesting. It's an event that wasn't created. It's a festival celebration, not of North American Quaker or Pilgrim origins, but like a lot of things, derivative. So it's perfectly all right. Isn't it curious how we become focused and our way of thinking becomes it? Our way of the way we're brought up, the way we're taught, and often we can go completely through a course of a life ignorant of the facts. In fact. The question we always want to ask is, what really is the truth? We're going to history. The reexamination of history has been really quite interesting. Even looking at the great epochs, the things that define us as a species. And hopefully, it's not the way that we celebrate the murders of each other through our wars. Certainly. It can't possibly be the impact that we have on our environment. Certainly it can't be. Nor should it ever be the indifference that we show to disadvantaged people. This notion of privilege seemed to have continued to play with it over the centuries. What I got, and I don't want anybody else. It's sort of that, I don't know, interesting part of the human condition. But then what is our truth? What causes us to ascribe to bigger and better things? And oh my goodness, you Masonic lot, where are you coming from? Falling off the face of the earth with this notion of the greater good and universality? Well, you boys have been staring at the skies far too much. It's actually penetrated your thinking to begin to question and begin to doubt. And oh my, when you start to do that, what do you fill the world with? Conjecture, curiosity, and science, inevitably. Here's a little tune that we're going to have some really interesting material today. I'm going to quote from from one of those diabolical characters that lingers in the shadows of Freemasonry. And the conspiracy theorists would just love to eat him up and suggest that we're all the same. If that were the true case, all conspiracy theorists would be the same. And they're not. They're great fun to have around because they're always, even when there is fact, we're never really sure if everybody landed on the moon. who in their right mind ever began to trust information coming from what we refer to as government? Because we could never separate out what's serving government's purposes and what's the other truth. Always different truths. Here's a little sample of this, because it's such a beautiful time if you're around us. This is Vivaldi, that incredibly talented Antonio Vivaldi, who wrote something that's just so endearing. He's an Italian Baroque composer, and if you are in here just before the show starts every week, you'll hear Baroque music playing in the background. It's just something that seems to focus my mind, and I never would have guessed that. Now remember, I'm the product of how many generations of Scottish Canadians, farmers and fishermen and blacksmiths, and who would think that we could actually come to develop a taste? Well, if all my ancestors and all your ancestors had access to the things that are around me and you today, they would be scandalously advanced. They would be enjoying themselves as much as you and I, Antonio. So this is a boy that was born on the 4th of March, 1678. And he lived a pretty good life. He died on the 28th of July of 1741 in Vienna. Ah, you know, you're born in Venice and then you travel to Vienna, Austria. I mean, life was good. He's a composer and a virtuoso violinist. And he taught, and he's also a cleric, which may have something to do with his vocabulary. And his best known piece, we're going to play a piece of that, are violin concertos. And he wrote 40 operas. If you're tempted at all, start off with something like Opera Pelia. This is he met Emperor Charles VI, yes, and then he moved to Vienna, and The ignominious ending was after he moved to Vienna, the emperor died shortly after Vivaldi arrived, and less than a year later, Vivaldi died in poverty. Yeah. This is a man who had written a lot of compositions for a female chorus, composed of children from a home for abandoned children where Vivaldi was employed. As an ordained Catholic priest. There you have it. Listen to this. It's charming music. Thank you. between the summer and the impending tension of winter, we have this brightly composed music that brings to mind that change, that anticipation, season here. This is very much, I think, the season, the music for Canada. Canada, the nation of audacious people. Isn't any wonder masonry thrives here. And I say thrives knowingly. We are a small population in a very large country, one of the largest countries in the world. Our day will come. We are stewards of this great nation, just as we are stewards of masonry. As the first Earl of Shaftesbury said, here, think about this. Men of sense are really but of one religion. Pray, my lord, what religion is that which men of sense agree in? Madam, said the Earl immediately, men of sense never tell it. Seneca the Younger said, even while they teach, men learn. It's important. Pass on what you've been taught. And we learn from the effort. If one does not know to which port one is sailing, no wind is favorable. It's from around 4 BC, I can imagine. Long time. Well said, though. As Robert Surface said, the clock is always slow. It is later than you think. Do we need goals? Yeah. It's a way of understanding our successes and our situations as we move along. When we, the workers, all demand, what are we fighting for? Then we'll end this stupid crime, that devil's madness war. That's from Robert W. Service. We have, I think, a useful topic today that I hope will challenge. I need your, I very much need your assistance here. This is talking about the secret patterns of Freemasonry. And of course, make your determination about what we're meaning by secrets. It's titillating to think that we have secrets. To have secrets is somehow considered privilege. We have grown on a whole organizational structure based on this notion of privilege. We've produced this phenomena known as lawyers to preserve law. Right? And whether they're not talking about the facts, what they're talking about is what can be proven. And as we move into the psychology of law, it is very often evident to us that we make mistakes, not in our perception, but in our thinking of what we see, our understanding of what we see, our understanding of our perception is a little deeper and a lot less understood. And so it gives latitude to different ways of analyzing and understanding events in the past. More to the point, it suggests that every Mason needs to be able to understand our circumstance, our perspective in life, by understanding the things that have gone on before us, because every culture has a different history. And to look at a culture and ignore their history is simply ethnocentrism, smugness. It makes us feel wonderful to say, what's wrong with that bunch? Why aren't they as advanced and as progressive as we? sounds quite foolish. When you, any man can stand up and erase 1,000 years of another culture, 1,000 years of history, or 2,000 years of history. I don't think it's meant to be arrogant. It's a bit silly, really. A bit childish if it wasn't so serious. Tantalizing, though it is, to have secrets. Those of a Freemason are as evident as the color of his eyes or the measure of his gait. Patterns of behavior hidden in view tell the careful watcher much more about the man than what is said. What drives men to exclude women from this organization? Oh my. Perhaps it would be anticlimactic to tell you it is by design not to exclude, but to categorize. It is oak beside maple. Why is one different? How much does it matter? They are trees with a beauty and character we ascribe. So be kind when you think of Freemasonry. It is not perfect, and neither are the men who join it. Today, practitioners of the Masonic arts and sciences struggle to understand their obscure provenance and wonder if aspiring to the principles are as altruistic as claimed. Today, we need to be able to talk about the discovery of utopia as a moment in time. And then, a harsh mistress who extracts it at toll for favors. Time. Time is not easy. Remember, we're talking about the patterns, behavior. We act in patterns, and when we step out of those patterns, we often feel a discomfort. Yeah, Freemasons are expecting to do that. Out there in the world, we have our bumper stickers, making good men better. Well, this isn't exactly something that we want to hide. This is something that we're very proud to display. I don't know how to measure the pride we feel against the sin of pridefulness. Can't be helpful. But we're not, by design, exclusionary. But we categorize. Why do oaks grow near to one another? Circumstance. Are they at fault for not having maple trees mixed in with them? Perhaps. You struggled somehow to explain why not women in an age, in a nation where we are finding that the universal construct doesn't have gender. We ascribe to something not as a loss, but as a beginning. An emergence, a new way of thinking, not at the loss of privilege and rank or order, the change in subservience of the workers' struggle. Listen to Bernie Sanders, and you get a quite a powerful message about what is important to preserve. We tolerate a great many things. And the experiments that produced us, educational experiments, the social experiments, the economic experiments, have been spent. And now we're in a new state of reforming and moving on. We always will. And for those faint at heart, we may need to strategically take a few steps back in order to win these battles. Unless you're one of the clumsy people that decides that your army needs to be massacred, everybody over the top, straightforward, follow the guns. And if you're not supporting that notion, then you must be the enemy. Excuse me. It's a little hard to believe, but, you know, people think that way. They do. Bill Thomas Paine, we picked up on that last week. I thought, like many of you, this was just brilliant. This is a want to know the what influenced the thinking. Listen, men of the day, days gone past, were no more empty-headed than you or I. We had ideas, but we needed content and men of letters to help give us that narrative, to help explain the narrative and put our thoughts into a way that could be communicated. Thomas Paine is quite the article, isn't he? This is an investigation of true and fabulous theology. And that was a pamphlet that was written by, Paine was British and American. He was a revolutionary. And this challenges institutionalized religion and the legitimacy of the Bible, even. Can you imagine? You've got, you know, as Jimmy Buffett would say, you've got fins to the left of you, fins to the right of you. You've got Quakers and Pilgrims running around, Puritans running around, the thinking being that we need to have that severe sense of uniformity and conformity in order to be successful. And look what it produced. Look what it produced. That kind of blind rigidity. Never the efforts of reasonable men. And here we come, here comes a man challenging that with, we could think, reasonable effect. This was published in three parts, in 1794 and 1795, in 1807. So remember, this would be material read by bright men who wanted to be informed, just to be able to understand the reasoning. It caused a bit of a revival of the theistic movement. We don't need to get into that today. We've talked about that in other programs. But the British audiences were really quite concerned at the time about increasing political radicalism. Now, you can imagine the French because of the French Revolution, there certainly was reason to be concerned, and they were not as welcoming to this kind of premise as the Americans. Here, give a listen, and we'll be back. We'll talk about
peace. I also will make mine, and I do this with all that sincerity and frankness with which the mind of man communicates with itself. I believe in one God and no more, and I hope for happiness beyond this life. I believe the equality of man, and I believe that religious duties consist in doing justice, loving mercy, and endeavoring to make our fellow creatures happy. But lest it should be supposed that I believe in many other things in addition to these, I shall, in the progress of this work, declare the things I do not believe, and my reasons for not believing them. I do not believe in the creed professed by the Jewish Church, by the Roman Church, by the Greek Church, by the Turkish Church, by the Protestant Church, nor by any church that I know of. My own mind is my own church. All national institutions of churches, whether Jewish, Christian, or Turkish, appear to me no other than human inventions, set up to terrify and enslave mankind and monopolize power and profit. I do not mean by this declaration to condemn those who believe otherwise. They have the same right to their belief as I have to mine. But it is necessary to the happiness of man that he be mentally faithful to himself. Infidelity does not consist in believing or in disbelieving. It consists in professing to believe what he does not believe. It is impossible to calculate the moral mischief, if I may so express it, that mental lying has produced in society. When a man has so far corrupted and prostituted the chastity of his mind as to subscribe his professional belief to things he does not believe, he has prepared himself for the commission of every other crime. He takes up the trade of a priest for the sake of gain, and in order to qualify himself for that trade, he begins with a perjury. Can we conceive anything more destructive to morality than this? Soon after I had published the pamphlet Common Sense in America, I saw the exceeding probability that a revolution in the system of government would be followed by a revolution in the system of religion. The adulterous connection of church and state, wherever it had taken place, whether Jewish, Christian, or Turkish, had so effectually prohibited by pains and penalties every discussion upon established creeds or upon first principles of religion, that until the system of government should be changed, those subjects could not be brought fairly and openly before the world, but that whenever this should be done, a revolution in the system of religion would follow. Human inventions and priestcraft would be detected, and man would return to the pure, unmixed, and unadulterated belief of one God and no more. Every national church or religion has established itself by pretending some special mission from God, communicated to certain individuals. The Jews have their Moses, the Christians their Jesus Christ, their apostles and saints, the Turks their Muhammad, as if the way to God was not open to every man alike. Each of those churches show certain books, which they call Revelation, or the Word of God. The Jews say that their Word of God was given by God to Moses, face to face. The Christians say that their Word of God came by divine inspiration. And the Turks say that their Word of God, the Quran, was brought by an angel from heaven. Each of those churches accuse the other of unbelief. And for my own part, I disbelieve them all. As it is necessary to affix right ideas to words, I will, before I proceed further into the subject, offer some other observations on the word revelation. Revelation, when applied to religion, means something communicated immediately from God to man. No one will deny or dispute the power of the Almighty to make such a communication, if he pleases. But admitting, for the sake of a case, that something has been revealed to a certain person and not revealed to any other person, it is revelation to that person only. When he tells it to a second person, a second to a third to a fourth, and so on, it ceases to be a revelation to all those persons. It is revelation to the first person only, and hearsay to every other, and consequently, they are not obliged to believe it. It is a contradiction in terms and ideas to call anything a revelation that comes to us at second hand, either verbally or in writing. Revelation is necessarily limited to the first communication. After this, it is only an account of something which that person says was a revelation made to him, and though he may find himself obliged to believe it, it cannot be incumbent on me to believe it in the same manner, for it was not a revelation made to me, and I have only his word for it that it was made to him. When Moses told the children of Israel that he received the two tablets of the commandments from the hands of God, they were not obliged to believe him, because they had no other authority for it than his telling them so. And I have no other authority for it than some historian telling me so. The commandments carry no internal evidence of divinity with them. They contain some good moral precepts, such as any man qualified to be a lawgiver or legislator could produce himself without having recourse to supernatural intervention. Note, it is, however, necessary to accept the declaration which says that God visits the sins of the fathers upon the children. It is contrary to every principle of moral justice. End note. End part 1, section 1.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
You can see the approach in the thinking, can't you? The openness, opening up and examining assumptions by reason. Now, you can also imagine why this caused such reaction in people. We are talking about interpretations that were considered the cornerstone of the culture. This mind is examining all religions. Now, and looking and reasoning through the fantastical, not to be pejorative, and he's certainly very clear about that, but to allow us to understand what it is we are accepting. Perfectly reasonable, as Payne is hinting, but at least understand what that reasoning is based on. Because if you believe it, you believe it. Now, if Masons of the day were asked if they subscribed to this type of reasoning, it might be enough to define the group as radical in their viewpoints if they admitted that they had read this. Book burnings are usually a way that the state or the church would try to kill off the message, ignoring this process of natural law. Get rid of the book, therefore the idea dies with it. We condemn that book for the ideas in it. Therefore, we condemn the ideas. Therefore, we're suggesting that if a good man read that book, he would not have the ability to reason through it for himself and make decisions for himself, but would be so swayed by the inopportune content. This is what led us, if we move on, to one of the most, I guess, deliberately scandalous people. If you and I went up through our life, known to me, sir, if you and I set out to be the dilettante, yeah, just think about that. That's your purpose. It's not that you happen to be described that way, but you found this idea fascinating when you discovered it. A dilettante is a person who cultivates an area of interest in the arts without real commitment or knowledge. It's a stage. They're setting up their life with props because it defines them. It suggests to thinkers like you and I of a certain shallowness of character. And this happens considerably. Politics is based on this kind of reference. Not the lions of the past that defined cultures, but the pretenders who have an appetite for power, and understand how to manipulate information to project themselves in a particular way. So this is a fellow that I suggest to you is less than authentic. This is Aleister Crowley. Yep. Oh, yes. The one, the very one, the namesake of the song done by Metallica. Yeah. That's one and the same. An English occultist and, oh, ceremonial magician. Yeah. He was a painter and a poet and a novelist. And he wrote, he was the author of the Book of Lies. He was born on October 12th, 1875. So we're close to acknowledging his birthday tomorrow. And he died on the 1st of December of 1947. He was married. Yeah. And not very long, but he founded the Ordo Templi Orientis, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, and the ancient and accepted Solar Lodge. A little taste. Here's just a little taste. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Really? No, I won't judge this. You just let this sink in. This is the boy. Modern morality and manners suppress all natural instincts, keep people ignorant of the facts of nature, and make them fighting drunk on boogie tales. I slept with faith and found a corpse in my arms on awakening. I drank and danced all night with doubt and found her a virgin in the morning. Little bit sensationalist, little bit, obviously. So we're going to be, let's see that we're being presented with a person who is the dilettante. Yeah. This is, where do we begin? We'll give some quotes. Here's the 50. This will help us perhaps understand the man. One would go mad if one took the Bible seriously, but to take it seriously, one must be already mad. Don't know if I agree with that. Inevitably, anyone with an independent mind must become one who resists or opposes authority or established conventions, a rebel. If enough people come to agree with and follow the rebel, we now have a devil. Until, of course, still more people agree. And then finally, we have greatness. Really? I don't necessarily agree with the premise that you're following. Very, very presumptive here. Maybe he thinks, you know, he's a bit condescending in these notions. Here, listen. The essence of independence has been to think and act according to standards from within, not without. Yeah. According to standards from within. Yes. That's the actions of any good person. You didn't invent this. You're reflecting. So, oh my, don't tell me, Aleister, you're a bit derivative. The joy of life consists in the exercise of one's energies. I could agree with that. Continual growth. I think that's reasonable, do you? Constant change. What say you about that? The enjoyment of every new experience. So far, we seem to have no issues. To stop means simply to die. Really? Do you agree with that? The eternal mistake of mankind is to set up an attainable ideal. This is from the Confessions of Aleister Crowley. I'm not sure I agree with that. The eternal mistake of mankind is to set up an attainable ideal. Or what's a heaven for? We always strive, it's not a mistake, we have an ideal in mind. And yes, we say it's attainable, but we also declare that we are incomplete and have not finished the work necessary to attain those ideals. But we have them, and I believe they're legitimate. We might have goals to our objective. The eternal mistake. Who's judging this as a mistake? You? Let's say your goal is to work so hard that you educate yourself to improve your lot in life. And let's say that you work diligently to provide for yourself, your spouse, your family, to be a reasonable member of the community, to be a good friend, to be reliable, to be honest. Let's say your roots are in a disadvantaged proportion. Is that an attainable ideal, and is that a mistake? The ideal? To strive to experience or to face your capabilities, to discover what your capability is by repeated effort. The sin, which is unpardonable, he says, is knowingly and willfully to reject truth. Yeah, okay. Whose truth? Which truth? To fear knowledge, lest that knowledge pander not to thy prejudices. So as long as they're going along with my prejudice, bring them on. Yeah, he's talking about the sin, the ethos out there as being really feeble-minded. He's not. He mustn't have done well with well-read people. Probably, you know, excited some of the masses. Oh, you know, we want to give him more attention than he deserves. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. So have at it. Really? Silly. Just silly. I don't think there's anything sinister about that, but it is just. Magic is the science and art of causing change to occur in conformity with will. Conformity with will. You've given that a lot. I've perhaps overthought that. There's just a few little slivers here that I can agree with, but they're incomplete thought. Ordinary morality is only for ordinary people. Do you mean that with... we have great responsibilities? Is that what you mean? That as we progress, we have responsibility that weighs on us? Yes, I can agree with that. Ordinary morality is for ordinary people. I'm not so sure I'm ever anything other than ordinary. I think I want to think of myself as quite average. I don't have an ego to fuel. I don't need to conquer and dominate. I don't know this, Alistair. I don't know that a man is greater because he leads armies into battle or whether it is nobler for a small child experiencing cancer to face the pain of treatment courageously, to always have a smile on their face so that mom isn't saddened, to absorb and accept the inevitability of what's happening to them because they have no power. And then come out on the other end of that process and somehow reconcile the trauma and move on. Nobody braying about their traumatic experience. This is the nature of most people on the face of this earth, the majority of people on the face of this earth. Some men are born sodomites. Really? Some achieve sodomy and some have sodomy thrust upon them. Now, there's a thought that I wouldn't have understood to be within the context of the occult. Perhaps a little bit of unfinished psychological business there, a little personal, just trying to be sensational, but it does fit with the dilettante. Says these things, but I don't really know. Sounds cynical to me, doesn't it? Doesn't. And with the cynic, you know, the cynic, we can't trust because we never really know if what they're saying is what they believe or they're saying it for effect, whether the dilettante. What the eye doesn't see, he says, the heart doesn't grieve over. I guess there's a grain of truth in that, just what the eye doesn't see. If you're clueless, yeah. It is the mark of the mind untrained to take its own processes as valid of all men. Yes, naive. Untrained, yes. So the training is, I'll assume this, because he doesn't say it, of course. The training is to be able to hold an idea and examine it through the eyes of other people. He seems to be saying that if you begin to think that you have mastery, if you begin to, because your mind is untrained, you have one way of thinking, and that's you're trapped by it. Well, for people like Masons, we're trapped. That man is trapped because he cannot appreciate or empathize. Now, that's just all I want to, the time I want to spend on this. This complaining, rambling rubbish is the substitute which has taken place of love. There's much more written there, left from the time of Aleister Crowley. His sites are clouded with references to the occult and devil worship and da-da-da-da-da-da. And here he is using this term, you know, this is back in the day where people were in prison for being gay, where sons hid from fathers because of their orientation, where women had a much different role, where men were stratified, not because of their accomplishments, but because of their birth rank. Just remarkable. There you have the Aleister Crowley. Reason through for yourself. I don't expect you to necessarily agree with me about the fellow, but I find him, you know, I don't get the point. I really don't. Seems like an old fellow saying things that were just a little bit titillating to just a fringe group of people, and enough to have some people follow his ideas, and probably that is no different then as it is today. There's still fringe people, and was he attracted to the mysteries and arts and science of Freemasonry? Well, of course, the dilettante would feel any rock had to be overturned. So we'll look at his rocks and overturn a few of them. But you have to do that for yourself. I don't think I find this very enlightening at all. But when you and I hear something, someone on the fringes of Freemasonry, we need to be able to have a firmer understanding. So if we're ever quizzed, you know, not going to be about the subtleties of the order. It's going to be about something really, I find Crowley a bit clownish. I don't know if you do. I don't take it very seriously. I think we'll have to go on. And Alistair's memory will have to be the stuff of mischief without me. Without me ever doing anything with it again. We're going to just take a little bit of a musical interlude. This is from West Clare Fiddle. This is from County Clare. This man, John Kelly, is no longer with us. And you'll hear a bit of a Scottish lump. You remember the violin. So we have the violin theme from Vivaldi. See what you think of this. It's just a short little piece, but we'll be back. That was from a recording done in Dublin in the 29th of June, 1977. Here, a couple of months ago, I was listening to CBC and to a program, and some of you might have heard it. It was called Poems That Make Grown Men Cry. And the work was so, I thought it was an interesting storyline, but the work was just fascinating. The poetry was fascinating. I want to play a bit of it today. I can't do this material justice with my voice. So we'll play, I have speakers here that will tell you about them. This is Dulce Decorum Est by Wilfred Owen, and it's read by Kenneth Brennan.
Bent double like old beggars under sacks, knock-kneed, coughing like hags, we cursed through sludge, till on the haunting flares we turned our backs, and towards our distant rest began to trudge. Men marched asleep. Many had lost their boots, but limped on, bloodshod. All went lame, all blind, drunk with fatigue, deaf even to the hoots of tired, outstripped five nines that dropped behind. Gas. Gas! Quick, boys! An ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time. but someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or lime. Dim through the misty panes and thick green light, as under a green sea, I saw him drowning. In all my dreams before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning. If in some smothering dreams you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in and watch the white eyes riding in his face, his hanging face like a devil sick of sin, if you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues, my friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie, dulce et decorum est, pro patria mori.
Wow. Just a little taste. We get to see what the author was revealing. How do words become more than letters on a page and become meaning? And how does meaning become emotion? How does that happen? Oil to canvas, a composition. And it reveals a story or a picture. How does it draw pathos out of us? How does it connect experience with emotion in our mind? How does it happen that some art does that and some struggle and never achieve, never understand that? It's like the ritual that we see, either done well and without stumbling over lines, that's part of it, and then done to reveal that the performer understands what it is he's saying. And then, when he understands it, to begin to put emotion to the words. In other words, to put himself into the ritual, which is, I think you will agree, the nature of education and why we're intolerant of somebody that can recite rapidly because it's all about them, self-absorbed by their own history, their own self-consciousness. No need. We say this over and over again. There's no need. What we're looking for is you expressing the words and telling us and showing us what they mean to you. That's the pleasure of Freemasonry. To say that Freemasonry is just a social club or a gathering really doesn't do justice or honor the men who have been persecuted through the centuries, who have experienced the assault and infamy of government and church, who have been exterminated in an effort to put an end to what they believed in, to suggest that our gatherings are little more than men getting together to socialize really is an ignominious gesture. Enjoy the Thanksgiving. Absolutely enjoy it. Enjoy the best of what it's meant to be. From the early days around 1621, remember, we had this group of people that were a bit zealous, and they're living in Europe and started to get under their own skin in a way and came to somewhere where there was this sense of freedom, trying to escape accountabilities, which you never really do. But we can celebrate the abundance that we have around us, and I hope you do. And around the world, if people are out there, Masons and otherwise, tuning into the program, remember, regardless of your situation, it is part of the continuum, it's part of the spectrum of experience. You and I can no more predict the future today than we can tomorrow. So we do the best with what we have. We can always wallow in the mediocrity around us and be absorbed by that and be consumed by it. But good men choose not to live that way. I look forward to you joining. I hope you've been worthwhile and made a contribution to of a Masonic nature on Masonic effects. I'm going to play you out with the music of a Canadian icon, as they say. This is a bad boy from the East Coast, and Ashley McIsaac. So enjoy, and I look forward to being with you again real soon.